Esther 9, beginning in verse 5, verses 5 through 10. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. And in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. And Parshandatha, and Dalphon, and Espatha, and Paratha, and Adalia, and Eridatha, and Parmashta, and Arisai, and Aradai, and Vajazatha, 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they. But on the spoil laid they not their hand. It's notable at this point that the great day of the contest between those who were votaries of false religion, the Persian fire worship, and the adherents of the true religion, this contest has now come. And the question is, who shall win the day? Now our text says that the king's commandment and his decree is near to be put in execution. I think I noted before that this appears to refer to the second decree particularly, which can be more properly ascribed to the king, since the first is now pretty well noted to be the work and associated with that wicked man Haman. However, I don't know if I've mentioned this in a while. I do think I mentioned it some time ago. But there is this rabbinic rule when reading Esther. It instructs people who are reading Esther to understand that whenever the king is mentioned, Hamelech, the king, without invoking the name Ahasuerus, that the real intention of the author is to speak of God. Because, you see, he really is the one who is the great king over the kings of the earth. And, frankly, along the lines of that rule, I think if we were to look back at some places where I may not have pointed this out, it does very often appear to be the case that you could view it that way throughout this book. Here, especially, I would say we can perceive the will of the Almighty over ruling and reigning in the midst of men if we use this rule. Because surely we can understand that this second decree is actually from God. It's God's will being done in earth even as in heaven. So, in accordance with this rabbinic rule, we are, in a sense, positioned to see God's providence as it's governing with a special eye toward the preservation and prosperity of the church. First of all, let me point out something here. Our attention is turned to the outward estate and expectation which had arisen throughout the empire under the reign of Haman, the prime minister. He was the previous grand vizier or prime minister of the Persian kingdom. But we're told in this chapter that his wicked decree had created the prospect of an outward hope and even held forth a promise of royal support for those who were numbered amongst the enemies of the Jews. Now, those who were hostile to the interests of true religion, who, by the way, are also those who are hostile to God, they're actively at enmity with God, they were set on giving vent to their animosity to the true religion through what they believed would be a gaining of mastery over the Jews, killing them, spoiling them of their goods, and so on. But whatever had been their dispositions prior to this decree, the second decree of the king, we see that they had cherished hope as a result of it, that first decree. Once more, then, I would point out this, We see this again and again in Esther, and that is the heathen are characterized by being led about by their relationship to outward providences alone. The heathen, their hopes and their dreams, their all of their security is bound up in providence and whether or not providence seems to be going their way or not. So when providence seems to smile upon them, they hope. And I think that's the idea here. Their trust is set upon what they can perceive through their senses. Because they are, after all, worldlings, right? They are creatures of the dust. Now, this stands in stark contrast to the stance of the faithful who, by faith, believe against hope sometimes, even as Abraham. As Paul tells us in Romans 4:18, speaking of Abraham, he says, who against hope believed in hope, that he might become the father of many nations, according to that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. For the faithful, then, the outward prospects of this world may provide no good hope. But the faithful are not focused primarily on providence. They're focused on precept, or they should be, if they're faithful. And that means that they trust in that which is spoken, first of all, in the Word of God. Now, second, while the heathen, then, trust to their sights and their senses and what they can perceive to be the smiles of providence upon them, the Jews are not really looking to providence, and that's probably a good thing right now, because it's actually at least up until this point, it's been very discouraging. They place their trust rather in the true God. And we know this because of their prayer and fasting. What they've done is they have placed their hope outside of this world and anchored it in the world to come. And it's from thence, then, that their aid will come. And so, as our text continues, the Jews end up having the rule over those who hated them. What's interesting here is this, and I don't think I can emphasize this enough. The very things which were portends to the heathen of their victory actually become the occasions of their defeat and subjection. And what the heathen had wished upon the Jews, they actually found it befell themselves. And in this, they probably were going to make a confession like that of Adonai Bezek of old when he confessed in his defeat in Judges 1:8. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings, having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their meat under my table. As I have done, so God hath requited me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Remember Adonai Bezek? They cut off his thumbs and toes. And he confesses that that was his just reward. So this is what it means then when we would say the Jews against hope believed in hope. That is, they believed against the hope that they could perceive in this world or by providence. But they believed in that hope that was held forth in the Word of God, in the precept of God. They hoped in His Word, and He saved them. Third, when we're told that the fear of the Jews fell upon all the people, we're reminded of this, that had fallen nature taken its course, the hope of their enemies would have turned into reality, would have been realized. Without that second edict, the effects of this fallen world would have destroyed the Jews. But instead, a different spirit is moving through the Persian Empire, and the king and his entourage have all been swept up in its train. So both the people and, as verse 3 indicated, the various officials in their official capacity are set on the side of the Jews. Now, although I have placed these verses in a typological light, giving them eschatological significance as types of the conversion of the Gentiles when the Jews themselves are grafted into the church again shortly prior to the millennium, there is a caveat that needs to be noted here. I did say that our immediate concern is not to discern who is and who is not really converted. This is, after all, a question which can only be answered satisfactorily by the individual. And so the church, in her terms of communion, the church does not seek to restrict communicant membership only to those who are actually regenerated or converted, because the church knows the inward work of the Spirit upon individuals cannot be known with certainty. It doesn't mean that you don't have hints or indications or anything else. It simply means that the church is looking for fruit, not trying to discern the root. The church is seeking fruit, a sound profession, an outward conversation, walking worthy of that profession, because that's all that we are really capable of judging. However, it is important to realize that only those who have a genuine working of the Spirit will bring vitality to the Church of Christ. Properly speaking, the visible church is the same composition as the invisible church, in that it consists of the elect. The Belgian Confession is actually pretty clear on this point, and their clarity on this is important. It's important for reasons that are not, perhaps, or were not as pressing the Westminster Assembly, to be clear on this point. But the visible church exists for the benefit and for the service and as the outworking of the confession of faith on the part of the elect. So that those who are members of the visible church and are not regenerated, not converted, particularly not elect, those people are only improperly said to be members of the visible church. So whether or not you're a convert to the faith, although it's not something that we can discern with certainty, it is something important for you to examine. Which is why the apostle says to examine yourself and try and test yourself to see if you're in the faith. Now, it may well be that many of those who sided with the Jews, besides those that were explicitly noted as being converts to the faith at the end of the previous chapter, that many of those have done so only for political or outward reasons. It's very possible. If you were to ask many of them, why have you done these things on behalf of the true religion? The reply of a lot of them, if they were honest, might actually be because they thought it would please the king, or because it would stand in favor of the people, or because they literally feared the Jews. Whereas familiarity with true religion would make one possessing genuine faith say something more along these lines. He would say something like, I believe the true religion because I know myself to be a sinner, and I know that Christ is the Savior of sinners. And I'm a member of the true church because I believe its doctrine and its discipline to be that held forth in the Scriptures. That's why I've made the choice that I've made here. An outward profession, after all, alone is not going to save you. Nor will a favorable disposition toward the true religion be enough to carry you to heaven. But for the purposes of the Jews, and those who do profess the true religion, it can be helpful to have others giving aid to them. So let's begin looking at verse 5. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies. So what do we know? In this verse we begin to learn the nature of the rout and what it meant for the Jews when we're told that they ruled over their enemies. Now this verse begins, like most Hebrew verses, begins with the verb, they smote. Moreover, the verb in this case is in what is known as the hifel form, which is the Hebrew verbal form that expresses causation. It's causative. The word refers to striking something so as to cut it off, or to remove it from the way. So in this case, it means to strike so as to cut off from the earth or kill. What this means is this. The picture we have is this. With God on their side and the Persian monarch at their back, the Jews are being portrayed here as going forth very aggressively against all their enemies. Importantly, however, not only the ferocity of the Jews against their enemies is noted, but there is a limitation of their actions. They're not acting this way against everyone. Only against those who are identified as their enemies. Now, we should recall that some of the population, upon receiving the edict of Haman, were quite forward to unveil themselves as open enemies of the true religion. Right? Not everyone did that. In fact, most people did not. So whatever we want to say about that edict, yes, it did create an occasion. But just like leaving money sitting around gives an occasion to the thief, most of the people don't take the money. Most of the people, even though they would like that money, don't avail themselves of it. They know it's not theirs. And maybe there were other people in the Persian Empire, the Persian Kingdom, who disliked the Jews or some of the Jews or a particular Jew here or there for some reason or other. But their hatred had not grown to the point where it had become tied to the idea that a pogrom against an entire race of people would be a good thing. Many, as a result of that, remained on the sideline in this contest. And although there's no moral virtue in remaining neutral in a conflict of such a nature, a moral conflict or a conflict about the nature of true religion. Although there's no moral virtue in remaining neutral there, those people, at least, are not accounted enemies of the Jews, and they're not made subject to this kind of vicious assault that we're told is made here. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword. These words begin to complete the sense of that verb, smiting, by tying it to the sword. The Hebrew literally calls this the wound or the blow of the sword. The root of the word stroke or wound is used actually to describe the process of flogging. The image is that of continually striking down their enemies. They're taking a sword and hitting them, hacking away, like someone trying to hack his way through a forest or a jungle. Maybe like the blade of a lawnmower whirling around and cutting off everything in its path. It's a vicious assault. More fittingly, I think the Jews are here being portrayed as reapers cutting down the chaff for the burning. That's really what's going on here. The word sword in Hebrew is actually related to the word for ruins. That was the mission of the Jews on that particular day. To ruin the plans of their enemies. And they do so by taking up the sword and smiting them. Whacking them again and again and again. They're persistent. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter. Now this word can simply connote killing. However, in the context, it actually seems to carry the notion of slaughter, like a great slaughter. A great killing. The Jews are creating here what we might call today killing fields. Now you might ask, what's the difference between what was noted with the smiting of the sword and now with this word with slaughter? The rabbis actually suppose this distinction meant that they first made their enemies to suffer by the edge of the sword as they were hacking into them, that they kept hitting them and hacking them, perhaps not deliberately killing them, and then finally, after a time, after these people were writhing in pain and hacked up, they would then finally finish them off, give them the coup de grace, the mercy blow. Their thought was that these enemies, because of their affiliation with Haman, that these enemies were also affiliated or to be associated with the Amalekites. And that made them subject to the command to utterly kill them and remove all memory of them from the land. And hence, and destruction. The stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction. This word is closely related to the word Abaddon. You may remember that word from the book of Revelation. It's a word used to describe the ruin of those consigned to hell. Job actually uses this word a few times. For example, Job 26:6, hell is naked before him, and destruction, that's the same word, Abaddon, hath no covering. This is the result, then, of their cutting off of their enemies. They're driving them, as it were, by sword. They're hacking them and driving them like cattle off the face of the earth. They're pursuing them, as it were, to hell. And the smiting of the sword and the slaughter leads to this utter destruction, which in turn, this word, the Greek word here, which is a form of abaddon, that word, I think, implies eternal consequences awaiting them. So the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. Again, the hatred of their enemies is noted very prominently in this verse. What the Jews did, we are told, they did only to those that were their enemies. And we are further told that they did this to their enemies because their enemies hated them. So in this context, the hatred of their enemies has to be understood to be aimed at both the true religion and the true God. You can't hate the people of God, the church of God, the true religion, and not hate God. So they're purging the land of those who entertain an active hatred. A hatred that was prepared to show itself in the slaughter of the Jews had not the providence of God turned the tables on the enemies of his people. Now, let me also note here, the words translated "did what they would" actually mean more like this: they did as they pleased. That means there was no one who was prepared to stop the Jews. There was no one commanded to stop the Jews. There was no impediment to stop the Jews. Nothing but their own internal restraint was in place to stop the Jews. They could do what they wanted as they unleashed what was really a righteous vengeance upon their enemies. Now, this chapter in Esther has received, I think, a lot of criticism from Christian commentators. They tend to think that this exhibits something less than the spirit of the gospel, as though the Jews are overreacting or simply carrying out some cruel revenge. However, I would remind people who are of that mindset that the psalmist says, in Psalm 97:10, "Ye that love the Lord hate evil. He preserveth the souls of his saints. He delivereth them out of the hand of the wicked." You see, loving God actually entails abandoning a position of moral neutrality. Loving God means you don't have a right to tolerate evil. You don't have a right to be at peace with what is unjust or wrong. Loving God means you must hate evil. In fact, we could say, in some sense, the way the psalmist has juxtaposed these words, that he is indicating to us that hatred of evil and love to God, love to the Lord, these things are, in fact, somehow flip sides of the same coin, if you will. So I think the reality is this: the actions of the Jews display a zeal for righteousness in the keeping of the law, which requires that justice be done against the wicked. In fact, I think if people had a better sense of this idea today, if we hadn't degenerated into views of love that are simply sentimental, emotional pap, romanticism, that we would in fact understand that loving God means keeping his commandments. And it's a great mercy, not only to the people of God, but to all people who are willing outwardly to obey the moral law. It's a great mercy to them as well to see the penalties attached to violations put into effect. So when the Jews are killing those who are enemies of the true religion, the true God, they're doing it not only for themselves, but for all morally inclined people, all civil people. And there is a mercy. There's a benefit to that. In verse 6, we're told, and in Shushan the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. In Shushan the palace. Now we're told the slaughter of the enemies of the Jews was not only pursued throughout the various provinces of the king, but most importantly, at least for the establishing of the true faith, it was pursued to the palace itself. Herein we see the totality of the upheaval that occurs with casting down of the enemies of God's people and the true religion finding official recognition and sanction. Shushan itself must become a safe place for the faithful and a place where the true religion will be observed. Shushan is, after all, the hub of civil life in the Persian Empire. And if the true religion is not safe there, there is no guarantee it's going to be safe anywhere in the kingdom. There's no way to guarantee that, because at the heart of the beast, there is a beating that would like to drive the true religion out forever. So in Shushan the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed. Here again, the words for slaughter and destruction are used together. Now, it may be understood that they proceeded as they had elsewhere in the palace. You know, they brought this killing with a sword. But if we take the rabbinic line, putting a difference between smiting and slaughter, there are some who think that there's a little bit of a difference here, and that is that in the palace, rather than flogging them with a sword, if you will, and getting blood everywhere, that they simply would have killed their enemies here outright. It's thought the Jews might have refrained from actual bloodshed in the palace proper anyway. Although this Shushan the palace refers to the fortress of Susa, the whole complex, and that's what would have been accomplished. They were going after the enemies there. In either case, the point here is that their enemies have been brought down to destruction, to the pit, and the idea here is that any hope of the Hamanic faction in the government reviving, that's going to be cut off. This cutting off, together with that previously mentioned, I think typifies the period called Armageddon prior to the millennium, when the enemies of God's people are going to be brought to a great battle and destroyed. I think there's perhaps some idea or hint at that here. It seems to be a great slaughter, an Armageddon going on before the confirmation of this establishment. In Shushan the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. 500 represent the number of close followers of Haman scattered about the palace complex. At their head, as will appear in the next verse, there are 10 sons of Haman. These 500 men are men whose lives presumably are cut off because they shared the bloodlust against the Jews from their head Haman. And in this verse now, the Hebrew makes it very clear the 500 are specifically called men. not women and children, as we read, were being subjected to this kind of conflict elsewhere in the kingdom, but specifically men. And so I suspect that this is speaking of a purge that has to do more with the governing councils and various bodies assembled within the palace in the service of the king. And that would explain then why this quite naturally leads into Haman's sons being included in that number. It's very likely that nepotism would have brought his sons into places of power and trust, and now it was simply a matter of justice to see that they were removed together with all of the underlings that they would have, all the people that were serving their power base that were entrenched in the government. In other words, I think this signals the establishing of true religion in the Persian state. Now, we move on to the names of the 10 sons. And Parshandatha, and Dalphon, and Aspatha, and Paratha, and Adalia, and Aradatha, and Parmashta, and Arasai, and Aradai, and Vajazatha. Before commenting on these names that are given here, I want to take a couple of minutes to go over a couple of things that are important to keep in mind. First, all of these names, as I'm going to show or try to show you, seem to carry within them connotations of the Persian fire worship. These are names connected to the religion of the Magi. And so, we need to keep that in mind first of all. Right, that's an important thing. That, by the way, I think also goes to something I mentioned quite some time ago when I was talking about Haman, that he appeared to be a high priest of that Persian fire worship. And now this notion that all of his sons are bearing names relating in some way to this, I would say, seems to strengthen that idea. And that, I think, also helps to see the nature of the contest going on between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. This is a very similar contest now in the Persian Empire that early on in Scripture, we saw in the book of Exodus, between Moses and the true God and the gods of Egypt. Those 10 plagues were each one against one of the major gods of Egypt. Here, we see that this contest is, in some sense at least, a contest between the true God, who is sort of in the background, invisible to our sight, as it were, and the Persian fire god, or the gods in that pantheon of their polytheism. All right, second, the names, as they appear in the Hebrew, have very clearly been distorted and deformed. We have every reason to believe these are Persian names, old Persian names, but the Jews, in conquering their enemies, have assigned them the names they deserve, not the names they were given. So these all appear to be plays on words, and the Jews sort of mocking and making fun of the fire god, sort of like Elijah and the prophets of Baal, you know, challenging them. Where's your god? You know, perhaps he's going out for a walk. Perhaps he's relieving himself. Perhaps he's, you know, asleep and can't come answer the phone right now. Why won't he do anything? This is a similar thing. The Jews are mocking these names because ultimately they're really mocking people who are fire worshippers, this Persian religion. Again, we can detect actual Persian names underlying the forms. But it's important as we go through to understand that these names, all of them, bear the marks of having sustained the punishment of their enemies, the Jews, who wouldn't suffer so much as their memories to remain in honor. And I'm going to try to point this out as we go. I'm just trying to give you these things to keep in mind in generalities. All right, third, there's another very interesting thing about these verses, and I've put them all together, not simply because they're short verses, verses 7, 8, and 9, but because in the Masoretic Hebrew text, the Masora, which are the critical notes that were handed down among the scribes who kept the official text, the Hebrew text, actually prescribes a peculiar way of writing these names. One source says the names were written in three columns, top to bottom, and that they would have signified the three parallel cords on which the sons of Haman were going to be hanged. Another says the word "and" is to be kept to the left, and the names written perpendicularly on the right, one above the other. And it may be that they're really talking about the same thing, that because of the way this goes together, there is this unwritten or untranslated direct object marker in each of these. And so there might have been "and" just the vav and then the direct object marker and then the names. So that might have been the three columns. Not entirely sure. Anyway, this was said to memorialize the way in which Jewish tradition holds the sons of Haman were hanged. Remember how tall that gallows was? I commented on that some time ago, how tall the gallows was that Haman made. The idea is that they were hanged one above another from the top of that very high wooden tree erected by their father. Legend says that they were hanged like that under him. We're going to address that a little bit more in the future, I think. But this orthographic feature of the text, having them all in this perpendicular column, is undoubtedly one reason why the names are not all included in a single verse. Right, they're trying to create a visual in the text, if you will. The fourth thing that I want to note is this, and something else to keep in mind about these verses as I comment on them. The Masora, again, the critical notes, state that three letters are to be written smaller and one larger in the text. So, these are the letters. In Parshandatha, the Tau, the TH. In Parmashta, the Shin, the SH. And in Vajazatha, the Z, the Zion, were to be written smaller. But the Vav, the V in Vajazatha, was actually larger. It was to be written larger. Now the reason for this is a bit disputed. But I think as we go through, we're going to see at least one reason is there's this deliberate mangling of the names by the Jews that help suggest other meanings. That further help them mock these guys that they're hanging. However, the rabbis actually have another theory, which I may mention if we have time. I don't think we will, but if I don't get to it this week, the Lord willing, I will next, at least to mention it. Anyhow, fifth, the Talmud, both the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud, have noted this feature, the enlarged vav, the enlarged V. Now, in Hebrew, that V looks like a railroad spike. It's just it's a line straight up and down with a little head on the end. And according to the Babylonian Jerusalem Talmuds, that's to signify that all 10 sons were hanged upon the same gallows. That's why that big vav is being used. There's also this interesting instruction that when they're reading this, and remember they have to read, Esther's one of two books that are read in toto, in the synagogue at certain times. And the instruction for reading these verses, and I believe including a bit of the next verse, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, they're instructed to read all of these names in a single breath. And that, I've heard some rabbis talk about it and read on this, and they say it's a very difficult thing to do. But they're to pronounce them all in a single breath because tradition says that all 10 sons died at once. Their souls left their bodies at one time when they were hanged. So, those are some things to note about these verses before we actually look at these verses, or the names, one by one. So let's begin. And Parshendatha, and Dalphon, and Asphatha. So, the first name has been said to mean given by prayer or interpreter of the law. Now, you might think that these two meanings are unrelated, but I suggest to you that the true interpretation of the law is actually given by prayer. This actually has been a big theme in this book, hasn't it? Right? Remember the prayer and fasting going on throughout the book. This, as are all the names, as I said, this is a Persian name, but it, like all of the names, has been bent to yield meaning in the Hebrew. So, as mentioned, the Masoretes, those who were the scribes that kept the Masoretic text upon which our Old Testament is based, it's a translation of the Masoretic text. Masoretes have written the Tau at the end of Parshendatha, that TH, they've written it small in order to make the word look more like Parashnada. And the reason appears to be this. The word Parash means dirt. It actually refers to fecal matter. If you look in Malachi 2:3, it's translated dung. It also is used for the exposed bowels of an animal being sacrificed. Again, it's translated dung in Exodus 29:14. Nada means bespattering, or if thus written, nada, with a whether it's written with an aleph or a he, it means uncleanness. Now, in Persian, the name was probably Parshan, meaning one born of a high caste, a parson or person, or from Bursa, which is a word meaning fire, connoting a fire-worshipping priest. So, what is happening here is this. This name is being twisted by the Jews to remind one of the right dividing of the law, which has made this man to be treated like a sacrificial animal. Right? The Jews are rightly dividing the law. These fire priests haven't. And the end result is, like Judas, remember Judas, when in Acts it says he fell down and his guts spilled out? If you remember in the in the making of covenant with Abraham, God told him to split the animal in two and pass between it. We're told that God met with Abraham in between those two animals. What that was saying was this. In covenant with God, God's saying, if you keep my covenant, well, all is well. But if you break covenant, I'm going to rip you in half like this sacrificed animal. That's what happened to Judas, and that's what they're implying happened here to Parshan, or Parshendatha. He's wrongly divided the law, he's broken that covenant, and now he's going to die like a sacrificial animal. He will suffer the broken covenant curse. Dalphon comes from the Hebrew word dal, which means poor or miserable or wretched. And that was a Jewish nickname for a poor man. Now, the Persian name, properly speaking, was almost certainly Derpan, Durban means a guard or guardian of the temple. With the ending, however, that the Jews had put on it, his name now signifies dripping or weeping. And so, what they've done is they've taken the name of another fire priest who was to guard the temple of the Persian religion and make the people of God, that's his job, he's going to make the people of God weep. He's now been made to weep himself. And so God has wrung him out and made him weep. He was going to make the people of God weep while he was guarding that Persian fire worship, and now God is going to make him weep. Astatha in Persian would have been Aspadatha, meaning given by a sacred horse. Now in this case, the Jews have omitted the D in Data to obtain a secondary meaning. The name now means enticed gathering or storehouse. And so if we now recall how the house of Haman has been given to Esther and placed under the guidance of Mordecai, what we see is this fire priest is reminding us that all of Haman's wealth, all of his prosperity, all of his power has been turned over to the people of God. He might have thought he was given by a sacred horse in pursuit of this fire worship, but in fact, he's been made to be a storehouse for the people of God. And Paratha and Adalia and Aridatha. The name Paratha is a mangling of the Persian name Perdata. Again, the Jews have left out the D in Data to achieve a secondary meaning here as well. Paratha, right? They left out the D there. The Persian name, actually, that per it means lot. It means given by fate or by lot. Now, in Hebrew, paratha means fruitfulness, but it can also mean frustration. And it's related, interestingly enough, as the rabbis point out, to a word in Aramaic, perta, another form which means little or dirt or distress and shame. Toreth, spelled backwards, is Toreth. And that's a word the Jews used to indicate a woman's private parts. And that is why it's connected to the notion of shame, because nakedness is now connected with shame since the fall of man. So this man, who was a fire priest, a high priest in the Persian religion, one of those upon whom the lot has fallen by the direction of the true God, has been made to feel the shame of his father and his own sin. And what was fruitful to the Jews proved to be the frustration of their enemies. So that's the meaning of his name. Adalia was probably derived from Adaria, derived from the word Adar, or fire. Now the Jews are clearly heaping upon the fire worshippers scornful names at this point. We can see they're piling it on. The name now, as they've changed it, means I shall be drawn up of Yah, from the word Dala, to lift up. Now I want to point out, one of the things that fascinated the fire worshippers was the ethereal nature of fire. When a fire is burning, it's continually ascending upward mysteriously. You know, and anyone who is a pyromaniac is fascinated by that aspect of fire. They like to watch that fire go up. They're captivated by it. People still are. People who don't even need fireplaces will put in fireplaces just to watch fire burn. It's fascinating to people. But these people actually worshipped it. Why? You see, that mysterious upward ascent is a symbol of pride. So the fate of those who engage in such haughtiness and arrogance is going to be to have their own heads lifted up by the true God in a different manner. And here, that idolatry is being mocked, and attention is placed upon the fact that he's being hanged or drawn up or lifted up by the true God, Yah. Eridatha. Eridatha means offspring of a lion, or the decree of a lion, literally a lion's law. Its Persian original, Eriyadatha, again, lacking the D, is likely another one of these names compounded from another word for fire, or. Here, again, we see the mockery of the fire worshippers continuing as the Jews are pointing to the fact that he has been made to fulfill not just any decree, but the decree of the one who is the lion, Christ. Israel can't perish because Messiah has to come from their loins. Instead, those who sought to make them perish are going to find themselves to fulfill the decree in a different way. They're going to have to fulfill that decree, and that means they must die. Finally, in verse 9, and Parmasha, and Arasai, and Aradai, and Vajasatha. The name Parmashta contains that small shin, that small sh. The old Persian that's probably behind this is Farah Ma'ishta, which means the very first one, the one who is really first. What that refers to is one born of Barum. And Barum is the god Mars, the god of war. He's the one whose chariot was said to be drawn by horses breathing fire. Remember, Aspatha, he was given by a sacred horse? Right? These are probably the sacred horses breathing fire. The Hebrews hear in this mangled form a name which means superior instead. However, if the shin, the sh sound, is muted, it actually may sound to them more like a word meaning something like this. Because it's muted, in this case, not at the end of the word, but right in the middle. It divides it into two words which might mean fruit of death. So in this contest between the Persian gods and the pagan mythologies, the true God is demonstrating his superiority over them. And of course, for the house of Haman, the fire-worshipping idolaters, God's decree brings forth the fruit of death. Arasai. Arasai, the Hebrew form, means to poison with the venom of a snake. Aris. The original Persian name is thought to be compounded also from that word for fire or. It appears to mean something like this, lives among the fire. So, the message is that fire worshippers and all idolaters who take pride in living among the fire are in reality being poisoned with the venom of the serpent, Satan. And they will live among the fire in hell forever. Eridai also takes its original Persian form from the word for fire, or. It's probably from a word, Haridaius, which means the light of Hari. Hari Krishna, Vishnu, and all of that comes out of this. These Eastern religions all go back into this some time ago. There are Hindi holy men who try to tie their religion back as being older than Zoroastrianism and the Persian fire religions. But anyway, Hari is a name meaning lion, and it's also associated with fire. These letters are sort of interchangeable and can go back and forth, and that's because of its connection with, remember, Ahura Mazda, the good god of the Persians. So this is all in relation to this. In Aradai, it's hard to know whether the last syllable was to point to die, but probably. And that would mean pain or sickness or trouble. So it seems the idea here is that the delight of the Persian gods, as maintained through their fire worship, has become the source of their pain and their sickness and their trouble. And finally, Vajazatha is a name which evidently signifies son of fire. The Va at the beginning means fire. Zapta is, in Latin, would have been natus or son. Its Persian might have originally meant given of the best one, a reference to the gift of the Persian god, the chief good god, Ahura Mazda. It was written, remember, with that that Vav Yod, and that Vav was the one, that V was the letter that they enlarged. And Vav Yod means woe. So a lot of the rabbis think that woe is indicated by making that letter Vav, that V, large, and then the Zion smaller than usual for the same reason, to emphasize the woe. So his name not only begins with woe, but then has the sense of the bitterness of an olive. Zeth is the ending of the word, and that symbolizes a strong and bitter judgment. So those are the names of these guys, and their names are all significant when we take into account this contest between true and false religion. And the Jews are mocking them. They've taken their names and twisted them and mocked them and thrown them back at them as memorials of the wickedness and the foolishness of false religion. All right, finally, in verse 10, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil laid they not their hand. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha. Now, calling attention to the 10 sons, remember, 10 is a number of completeness. It's completeness of his judgment now falling upon the enemies of the Jews. Some of the rabbis, Rashi, for one, believe that there were more sons, but that these 10 sons are singled out for their abuse. Rashi, I think, thought there were 30 sons, 10 of whom are singled out here, because he believed that, along with a number of other rabbis, that they were ones who had heaped abuse upon the Jews who were trying to build the temple in Jerusalem, and they were trying to keep them from it. And they think it's referred to in Ezra 4:6, where it said, "In the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." So they assign that accusation to these 10 sons. Of course, it's not clear in our text whether or not that is the case, but what is clear from the Bible is, not only from the book of Esther, but from the Bible, these sons share in the fate of their father, and according to God's moral law, the only way this could possibly be justified would be if they had confirmed themselves in the guilt of their father through imitation of his sin. That's the point in Ezekiel 18, verses 19 and 20. Yet you say, "Why doth not the son bear the iniquity of the father? When the son hath done that which is lawful and right, and hath kept all my statutes, and hath done them, he shall surely live. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him." So clearly they've done wrong. And their wrong, not simply the wrong of their father, is behind why they are dying here. Haman's name, you may recall, in Old Persian means a great one or a magnificent one. And here it's coupled with his father's name, Hammedatha, a name which means double. Means, I suppose, that he should have been doubly great. And yet, Haman, from the verb Hama, means unrest or noise. And as I noted this some time ago, whenever the Jews read the story of Purim, they make a noise every time Haman's name is mentioned. Moreover, though, Hammedatha not only can mean double, it can also mean, if we split this word a little differently, he who troubles the law. So this noise arises as the son of one who troubles the law. all of this has come because Haman has troubled the law, the true law of God. For the Jews, then, the outcome should never have been in doubt. Yes, you could, like a Persian, think that Haman, son of Hammedatha, is doubly magnificent. But if you're a Jew looking at his name and giving it a second glance, maybe you should have realized there's going to be a lot of noise because this guy's breaking the law. 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. Again, Haman is noted particularly and peculiarly as the enemy of the Jews. Like most people in the Bible don't get that attached to them, that title, but Haman gets that. Many enemies the people of God may have, but Haman is one that stands out. That's the idea. And his sons are just like him. They're associated now with this, and as such, they deserve that imposition of justice when it's restored to the kingdom under Mordecai. They deserve what they're getting. So 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they. The Jews killed the 10 sons among the 500 in the palace, probably. Some people think that they're in addition to the 500. I think, in fairness, it probably is that they're numbered in that 500. Quite likely, they did so with a sword, as they had in the previous verses. They're quick to see that their enemies are dispatched, and the Jews recognize the imperative of the task before them. Right? Nothing that could undo the day's work could be left undone on their part. So the use of the sword would make sense. After all, the root word of the word sword actually is used in the word of war. And that should impress upon us the nature of the conflict. When we see this word sword being used, there's this idea of war. These are not two peoples living together in one kingdom. All right, that's not what's going on here in the Persian Empire. What we have really are two kingdoms, only one of which can survive. And that's the nature of our conflict in this world. It's a spiritual battle, but flesh and blood are taken up in the warfare. Nevertheless, as Paul says, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal but mighty to the pulling down of the strongholds of the devil and his soldiers. But this is what the Jews are doing. The enemy of the Jews slew they, but on the spoil laid they not their hand. So, this is interesting because of all the accusations that have been swirling around about the Jews. We gather that they were actually not motivated by money. It was not worldly concerns that drove their passions at this time. Instead, they demonstrate, very interestingly, little care for the spoils of war. They'd been accused as a wicked people whom it was good for mankind to destroy from the face of the earth. But their noble disinterestedness at this point is a refutation of that big lie. It's evident from their conduct that they're not lovers of money, and that they understood, at least at this point, that the love of money is the root of all evil. I think it's also been rightly noted that this clause stands as a reminder. If you recall, in 1 Samuel 15, King Saul fell from favor when he took the plunder and spoil and failed totally to destroy Agag and the Amalekites. Haman, we're told in this book, was an Agagite, spiritually, if not physically, of the seed of Amalek. Mordecai and Esther are descended from Saul. Here, then, we see the faithfulness of the children delivering the people of God from the curse of the wicked and redeeming the house of Saul in the annals of history. So, in conclusion, this example we should keep in mind is set before us not that we should take it upon ourselves to avenge injuries according to our own judgment. Rather, we should recognize the severity of the divine wrath against those who are impious persecutors of the people of God, and that in persecution we might most confidently expect deliverance through faith and be obedient to the calls of God and all that. That the Jews did just this is proved by their taking no spoil. In this, they're not like Saul, Remember, I suggested early on that set this in motion many years before, Saul not killing Agag. In this, however, they are like Abraham. Remember that? When in Genesis 14, the king of Sodom offered him prey at the end of the war, and Abraham refused to take it. The unbelieving Persians, for whom taking the spoil of a defeated enemy was the norm, would see their action here as indicating that disinterested nobility. And that might serve to impress upon them the purity of the true religion. From that, I think we can learn this. We need to learn to serve the interests of true religion without partiality for our own interests, and thereby we should be like Abraham, as they were here. Because Abraham, we're told, is the father of all who believe. Amen. Amen.